Consider a financial paradox that, honestly, completely shatters conventional business logic.
It really does.
Right. Imagine a company that grew its run rate by 12% last year. Now, normally, if a business is expanding at that kind of aggressive pace, it is a voracious consumer of capital. I mean, it needs to build, it needs to hire, it needs to spend.
Exactly. It needs fuel for that growth.
But this company, MSCI, did the exact opposite. Last year, they generated $1.45 billion in free cash flow, yet they returned $3.04 billion to their shareholders.
The math there is just staggering.
It is. They literally borrowed money to give away more than twice what they earned in cash.
And because they are deliberately executing this massive internal hollowing out, their shareholders' equity currently sits at a negative $2.65 billion.
Which is just wild. I mean, how do you even get negative shareholders' equity without going bankrupt? Usually that means your liabilities exceed your assets and the doors are closing.
Right, but MSCI is doing this intentionally.
They are taking their massive cash flow, borrowing even more cash on top of it, and aggressively buying back their own stock and paying dividends.
They are purposefully hollowing out the accounting value of the firm.
And that tension is the foundation of our deep dive today into The Infinite Investor, which is a book nested within the broader Averaging Up collection of investment essays.
And just to be clear up front, we are impartially reporting on the analytical frameworks presented in these essays.
Yes, exactly. These are concepts to grapple with, not something we are endorsing as an absolute truth, but the underlying math is fascinating.
It really forces you to hold two completely contradictory ideas in your head at the same time.
So we want to deconstruct this exact paradox to answer two vital questions for you. How long does capital actually last, and how hard does it really work?
To solve the MSCI paradox, we first have to dismantle a major flaw in traditional business literature.
Okay, where do we start?
Well, for decades, investors and analysts have historically treated two completely different concepts as if they were the exact same measurement. We have to firmly separate the growth runway from the reinvestment runway.
Right. Those get conflated all the time.
Constantly. Every single business on earth possesses both, but they are measuring entirely different objects. The growth runway is essentially the wave of demand.
Meaning how long the market a business serves can actually continue to expand.
Exactly. The reinvestment runway, on the other hand, measures the capacity to absorb. It defines how long a business can keep putting its own generated earnings back to work internally at, you know, attractive rates of return.
So we have been conflating the size of the opportunity with the cost of capturing it.
Yes.
And I think I know why. I mean, for the last 100 years, American business was largely defined by manufacturing. If Ford wanted to sell more cars, they had to build a new factory.
The demand and the capital requirement were bolted together.
Exactly. But let's look at this through a physical analogy to separate them for today's market. Think of the growth runway as the size of the ocean wave and the reinvestment runway as the size of the surfboard.
Oh, that's a great way to visualize it.
Right. Just because you don't need to keep buying a bigger and bigger surfboard doesn't mean the ocean wave is ending. A short reinvestment runway does not imply a short growth runway.
Which is exactly why the legacy manufacturing mindset fails us here. Both of these runways are durations, but they advance at completely different speeds.
And crucially, they're often financed by completely different parties, right?
Yes, absolutely. When we look back at MSCI, the paradox starts to resolve itself when you apply this separated framework. MSCI is currently riding two massive, independent waves of demand.
The global migration of capital into passive investment vehicles, for one.
And you also have the increasing, insatiable demand for private market benchmarking. Those are structural long-term trends. That is an exceptionally long growth runway.
But the surfboard they need to ride that wave, their reinvestment runway, is practically non-existent.
Because of the nature of what they sell. To supply the assets being tracked, you know, the indices and the benchmarks, MSCI requires almost zero incremental capital.
Right. If $1 trillion flows into an index fund tracking an MSCI benchmark, MSCI does not have to go out and buy the underlying stocks or bonds.
They just provide the math. So their reinvestment runway is remarkably short, not because their business model is failing, but because their physical capacity to absorb capital is negligible.
So the overflow of cash starts early in their life cycle and it never stops.
Exactly, even as the sheer volume of demand beneath them keeps rising year after year.
Okay, so if we accept that the runways are distinct, the next logical step is to figure out how to measure exactly how much capital a business actually needs to absorb that wave of demand.
We need a way to quantify the relationship between revenue growth and capital consumption rather than just guessing.
Right. So how do the essays in the Averaging Up collection tackle this?
The single most crucial metric for this analysis is what they term the elasticity of capacity.
Mm-hmm.
You have to ask a very specific mathematical question. How much additional physical capacity does $1 of additional business require?
Because this is not a binary question of whether a business absorbs capital or not. Every business on Earth absorbs some capital.
Exactly. It is a continuous spectrum. And to see how wide this spectrum actually is, we can contrast a highly inelastic physical business like Union Pacific Railroad with a highly elastic digital one like Visa.
Let's break down those numbers because the contrast is stark. Think about what actually happens when Union Pacific needs to capture more demand.
For them, capital expenditure consumes 15.5% of their net revenue.
And a massive 40.8% of their operating cash flow.
And that burden scales brutally and directly with their growth. If Union Pacific wants to move 10% more freight across the country, they essentially have to build 10% more physical capacity.
Right. The denominator follows the numerator in lockstep. They cannot just flip a switch in a server room. They have to purchase physical diesel locomotives. They have to physically expand the acreage of the rail yards. And they have to lay down heavier steel tracks to support the added tonnage.
The capital required is entirely proportionate to the weight and volume of the revenue they carry.
Precisely.
Okay, let me stop you right there because I am looking at the data from the essays regarding Visa.
Yeah.
And I am struggling to reconcile this with the theory.
Go for it. What's the sticking point?
Well, I want to push back on this comparison. The text shows that over a recent 3-year period, Visa's capital expenditure went up by 40%.
Right.
But their revenue over that same period only rose by 22%. If a company's capital spending is growing almost twice as fast as the revenue it's bringing in, isn't that the literal definition of becoming capital intensive?
It absolutely looks that way at first glance.
I mean, it feels like the whole elasticity argument falls apart right there. That is exactly the trap most analysts fall into when they just screen for growth rates without looking at the underlying architecture. It absolutely looks that way until you attach the absolute dollar amounts to those percentages.
Okay, lay the numbers on me.
Then you see the actual mechanics of elasticity at work. 40% of a tiny number is still a tiny number. Visa's capital expenditure went from roughly $1 billion to $1.5 billion. That is your 40% jump.
Okay.
But that $1.5 billion in CapEx is sitting against $23 billion in operating cash flow. Visa's entire capital budget is just 3.7% of its net revenue and 6.4% of its operating cash flow.
Ah, I see. So the base level is what actually defines the elasticity.
Exactly. The growth rate of the spending, that 40% jump that looks so alarming on a spreadsheet, is just statistical noise around a fundamentally tiny base.
So if Visa processes 10% more payment volume globally, it might require, what, 2 or 3% more capacity in its data centers?
Exactly. The profit rate holds incredibly steady while the absolute base of the business expands immensely.
Which forces us to ask a rather profound question. If Visa requires so little capital to grow its global network, who is actually paying for the infrastructure that allows them to process billions of more transactions every year?
Because the capacity isn't peering out of thin air. Real things have to be built for a digital payment to happen.
Right. It certainly isn't magic.
An earlier flawed assumption in financial analysis was that this capital must be hidden somewhere in accounting write-offs. Analysts assumed things like R&D or aggressive marketing spend were suppressing current earnings, but covertly building future capacity.
But the reality is far more interesting than an accounting trick.
It really is. The capital isn't hidden in Visa's income statement. It lives permanently on other people's balance sheets.
This is where we have to dissect the actual architecture of a transaction. Visa built and paid for the middle.
They finance the central data centers, the processing networks, the underlying digital protocols.
And the essays note they pay around $894 million a year to run that middle layer, but they didn't pay for the edges of the network.
Consider the sheer volume of physical and digital infrastructure required for Visa to earn a single fractional fee. A bank must hold the account, maintain the compliance, and issue the physical plastic card.
A merchant must purchase, install, and maintain a point-of-sale terminal.
A consumer must purchase a $1,000 smartphone capable of running a digital wallet. Telecommunication companies must lay down thousands of miles of fiber optic cable to route the encrypted message from the merchant to the bank.
Wow, right. Every single one of those components is real, productive, expensive capital.
And every single one of them was purchased by a third party for their own localized reasons, completely independently of Visa's capital budget.
It's brilliant. It actually reminds me of Warren Buffett's 1983 observation on See's candies.
Oh, the economic goodwill concept?
Exactly. Buffett noted that See's earned incredibly high returns on its tangible assets, which proved the existence of massive economic goodwill. People loved the brand so much they could charge premium prices.
Right, they had immense pricing power.
But even with that goodwill, See's candies still had to physically pay for its own growth. If they wanted to sell chocolate in a brand new city, See's still had to sign a new commercial lease, build a new physical shop, buy new display cases, and hire new staff.
Visa's growth is fundamentally different. It is funded by a massive, secular global shift away from cash.
And that secular shift is something Visa benefits from endlessly, but could never practically purchase outright.
The migration away from cash belongs to the global economy. It is driven by the daily habits of billions of households and the structural decisions of thousands of financial institutions. Visa just sits in the toll booth they built in the middle.
Which raises a fascinating philosophical question. Let's say Visa, sitting on its massive pile of $23 billion in operating cash flow, actually wanted to reinvest all that money to intentionally accelerate this global shift away from cash. Could they do it?
No. And that is the stark reality of reaching this level of elasticity. The engine of their growth is simply not for sale.
So a company in this position could sincerely desire to deploy its capital to buy more growth, only to find there is literally nothing to purchase.
You cannot buy a permanent shift in consumer behavior. Visa paid for its network once, but its ongoing infinite growth is paid for by the very customers who benefit from it. They conceal an economic base that expands entirely for free.
Okay, so once we understand who is paying for the growth, we have to pivot and examine the durability of the assets actually being bought.
Because having a long reinvestment runway, the ability to keep spending money, does not automatically equal a durable asset.
Right. And if you are holding big tech in your portfolio right now, you really need to visualize this next point. This brings us to the capital longevity matrix. Let's go back to Union Pacific for a baseline.
Union Pacific deploys capital with an extraordinarily long life. There are rail corridors laid down in 1862 that are still carrying freight today.
That's incredible. So their capital expenditure is 1.54 times their depreciation.
But when you look closely at the mechanics, $2 billion of their $3.8 billion spend is just perpetual replacement. They have a perpetual reinvestment runway, which is distinctly different from a long one.
A physical network that exists out in the elements must be maintained forever just to stand still.
Exactly.
The more illuminating comparison here is between Lind, the massive industrial gas company, and Microsoft. Both of these companies currently have enormous reinvestment runways.
They are both aggressively building massive physical capacity before the demand fully arrives.
But the nature of what they are building and how long it lasts is entirely different, right?
Completely different. On a basic screening metric, they look quite similar. They're both deploying billions. But Linders is building highly specialized industrial plants that will produce gas for 15 to 20 years. And crucially, they are locked under long-term take-or-pay contracts.
And Microsoft.
Microsoft is spending aggressively, currently 3 times its depreciation, building out massive server farms and cloud infrastructure to support AI and enterprise computing. But those specific servers have an estimated useful life of only 2 to 6 years before they become technologically obsolete or burn out.
Wait, let's unpack the math on that for a second. If they are spending 3 times their depreciation, that means they are building new infrastructure 3 times faster than their old infrastructure is losing its accounting value.
Exactly. They're scaling up extremely fast.
But analytically, doesn't this mean Microsoft's aggressive spending creates a massive underlying vulnerability compared to a company like Lind?
In what sense?
Well, if Microsoft is carrying $313 billion of physical plant on their books, and it all has a 2 to 6 year lifespan, does this mean they're running on an incredibly expensive treadmill?
Right.
One that never stops, even if their AI or cloud growth ways suddenly decelerates.
Yes, that is the exact arithmetic lurking underneath the surface here.
Mm-hmm.
Having a place to put your money is not the same as buying a lasting, durable asset.
Because that $313 billion of short-lived plant creates a ruthless, scheduled replacement obligation.
Microsoft will have to buy a massive portion of that physical infrastructure all over again before this decade is even out. That replacement bill arrives on schedule, regardless of whether their revenue growth continues at its current blistering pace or slows down.
It is a scheduled liability that a heavy industry company like Lind simply does not face in the same compressed time frame.
Exactly.
So bringing these theoretical frameworks down to a practical application for the listener, how do we interpret the financial signals of a business reaching its limits?
Well, the Infinite Investor lays out three very specific analytical checks to run when you are looking at a company's financials.
Let's walk through the mechanics of them. First, when you see CapEx rising, what is the actual signal we should be looking for?
When capital expenditure rises, you must look past the raw dollar amount and check if the spending is following the volume or lagging it. This requires calculating the ratio over a 3 to 5 year period.
Right, because if CapEx and revenue grow at the exact same rate over 5 years, the return on invested capital will eventually compress because the business is getting heavier.
But if spending grows meaningfully slower than the revenue it carries, like Visa's 40% CapEx growth on a tiny base versus their massive absolute revenue growth, the profit rate can hold perfectly steady while the business scales to infinity.
Okay, second check. When you see extraordinary returns on capital, you have to ask whose balance sheet the base actually sits on.
And as we established with the Visa example, you won't find this answer in the company's financial statements. Mm. You have to logically map out the physical world and ask what must exist for a unit of business to occur.
So if the required assets, the phone, the merchant terminal, the fiber optic network, are funded by third parties, that signals a deeply extended growth runway.
A business relying on third-party balance sheets can grow as long as those external parties keep spending their own money.
And the third check brings us right back to our initial paradox with MSCI.
Right, the short reinvestment runway.
Exactly. When a company has a short reinvestment runway, you cannot automatically conclude that its growth is ending.
This is perhaps the most common analytical error in modern finance. We really must reframe how we view the MSCI paradox. Finding yourself at a point where you cannot redeploy your own earnings at your historical rate of return is not a failure of management.
Right.
It is the ultimate mark of a company executing so exceptionally well that it has managed to out-earn its own opportunity set. It is an arrival at what the SEs call the crossroads.
Oh, I love that concept. It is very much like reaching the late stage of a resource management strategy video game.
How so?
Well, you spend hours optimizing your economic machine perfectly, tweaking every variable, and eventually you reach a point where you are generating 1,000 gold per minute.
But the most expensive item left in the shop only costs 10 gold.
Exactly. That overflow of gold isn't a glitch in the game, it's the trophy. It proves you won the resource war.
And if you take that video game analogy a step further, if you try to take that overflow gold and spend it on an entirely different game, say by making a massive, reckless acquisition outside your core competency, you usually end up ruining your own returns.
Right, so the safest, most frictionless move at that crossroads is simply to hand the money back. You consume the equity, you return the capital to the shareholders who gave it to you.
MSCI's negative shareholders' equity is not a distress signal. It is simply the mathematical footprint of a company efficiently dealing with unabsorbable surplus.
Which leaves us with a final, rather provocative implication to consider. We've established that the ultimate business model, the Visa model, relies on third parties like banks, merchants, and consumers unwittingly funding the physical edges of the growth runway.
Right, they provide the free capacity.
But what happens if those third parties eventually realize they hold all the leverage? If the telecommunication companies and the massive banking syndicates financing this free growth wake up to the reality of the balance sheet disparity, could they one day demand a toll of their own?
It is a massive question.
Could the very entities financing the free growth of digital monopolies eventually choke it off? It is a structural vulnerability hiding in plain sight.
It really is. Well, that wraps up our deep dive for today.
This content is educational and reflects a personal analytical framework. It does not constitute investment advice. Visit averagingup.com.